Motopod, proudly supported by Roadskin, a UK label specializing in protective outerwear for motorcyclists. Modern biker clothing that you can wear all day long and engineered to save your skin. For the road, for life, visit roadskin.co.uk. Welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 815, recording September 16th, 2025. We'll be discussing the San Marino GP. I'm Jim McDowell hosting, riding alongside Richard Jowett. Richard, how are things in the UK?
Dark, cold, autumnal, Jim, unfortunately. The lovely long hot summer that we've enjoyed here is, I think, pretty much over now. So, and of course, this weekend, we're into the, for me at least, the kind of 5 o'clock start to watch some of the MotoGP action from Motegi we have coming up, don't we?
Yes.
But we've got to get Misano out of the way first.
Well, here, summer has roared back in with temperatures in the 90s for the next few days.
Oh, lucky you.
Yes, that usually happens in September. We usually do have a few days of 90-degree weather, but it will become cool. It is, the nights are still cool, which is nice.
Yeah.
So I'll take that. Anyway, we're going to talk about the San Marino GP, but first, got to thank everybody who listens to the show, everybody who donates to the show. Can't thank you enough for all that. If you can't make a donation to the show, we understand, but hey, go tell your friends about us. Give us a like, give us a review, tell your friends about us. Every little bit of that helps, and we would greatly appreciate it. And with that out of the way, Rich, let's get to some listener feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this comes from Jake Rauer, and Jake was asking you about the Yamaha, new Yamaha V4 that was going to race this weekend in San Marino. And he's like, hey, is this thing an 850? Is it 1,000cc? And I'm like, well, you know, not really sure, because nobody has said in the media or asked the question, like, hey, is it an 850? Is it 1,000cc? And my reply back to Jake was, you know, hey, if I'm Yamaha, I'd build an 850. I'd put it in a chassis. I'd start racing it just to get a steal the march on my competitors while they're playing around with 1,000cc's. I'd work on developing that and moving forward with it, is, you know, as long as it doesn't circumvent a rule or something like that, to which I'm not aware that you can't run a bike that's sort of under capacity, right? I mean, it's your thing. And then looking at the lap times that that thing was producing, it was like a second off the pace of what Fabio Quartararo could do on the inline bike. And I'm thinking maybe they are running an 850, but you found out something interesting, didn't you?
To be completely candid about it, I didn't know the answer to it either, Jim. I mean, as you say, they haven't really, at least I haven't heard or read anything on the coverage that we follow to say anything much about it. I mean, rather embarrassingly, I was talking about the V4 Yamaha last time out. Completely, well, either I'd forgotten or I didn't even know that they were actually going to be bringing it out. So Yamaha obviously have been quite confident about the state of its development to put Augusto Fernandez on it and stick it out in a race weekend, as they have done. So that's the first thing. So that was my bad. You know, I didn't realise that was going to happen even. Anyway, I didn't know the answer to the question. So I, because I've got a WhatsApp kind of connection with Simon Patterson, who does know these things, I just shot, having read your email and in interaction with Jake, I just shot him a message to say, is it an 850 or is it 1,000? And he came back straight away to say, no, it's definitely 1,000. And the various manufacturers had a, inverted commas, gentleman's agreement, as they call it, not to run an 850 before 2027. So, which would imply that the rules might allow it. Whether you would score any points doing that, I don't know. Somebody has pointed out that whilst Yamaha might elect to run the 850 bike, or even race the 1,000cc bike, actually, no, they were talking about the 1,000, actually, they can't, the official riders can't do it, because they would be immediately breaking the homologation rules on the aero, for one thing, which would rule the bikes sort of ineligible. Thank you. I was going to say illegitimate. That's not, definitely not the right word. Ineligible. Ooh. Thank you, Jim. And yes, well done. It's normally the other way around. So And Simon made the point, actually, interestingly, that they probably wouldn't even get to race it because the bike would be deemed illegal through practice and qualifying. Therefore, it wouldn't be allowed to start a race, which I hadn't even thought of that before. So, yeah, interesting the way the rules kind of work on this. But no, it was definitely a 1000cc V4. Yamaha are obviously chucking an awful lot of resource at this thing, which makes some of Fabio's comments, which I guess we'll come to because we've had the one day test yesterday, and Fabio Quartararo has been, as he tends to be, somewhat vocal about things. I guess we'll come to that in a minute rather than touching on it now. But I mean, you said that the bike was a second and a half off the pace. So I think the conventional wisdom was actually pretty good because probably the engine's toned down a bit, I would imagine, just so that they don't have public failures going on. Because I remember, would it have been Randy Depuniet came out quite early when Suzuki came back in with their 1000? What would that have been? Probably 2013, 2014, perhaps, somewhere around about there. And I remember that thing spectacularly blowing up once or twice in front of the world, which the Japanese certainly back then didn't like and still don't particularly like that sort of thing to happen in the public gaze. So I wouldn't be surprised if the bike was running a little bit kind of lower down the power range than it's ultimately capable of. But anyway, we'll sort of get to see as time goes on how that thing performs.
So from my side, from like an engineer's point of view, okay, if it's 1000cc, he's like, yeah, you're chucking some bucket loads of money at that bike. But if you did it smartly and you said, okay, if we're gonna go to 850cc's, you have a couple of different ways that you could do that. You're either gonna have to have a shorter stroke and have the same size piston that you have in 1000cc, right? Or you can say, well, we're going to have a smaller piston and keep the same stroke in 1000cc. So you get those sort of your two options because physics demands with an aluminum piston that as it goes up, it has to have so much force that it has to resist as it slows down, stops, and then reverses and immediately and goes back the other way to suddenly stop and go back again. There's also so many feet per second that I could go find the equation for it. It tells you, well, you can't go beyond this because then it can't withstand that whole thing and all that good stuff. So Yamaha may have said, look, we pretty much think that we want to have a high revving or as high as possible. I'm sure there's some regulational thing in the book that says that 850 can only rev to X. And if it's, I think they have gotten to the point where they don't want pneumatic valve trains and all that other stuff that's in there and take all of that out of it, which is good, right? That's a cost thing. So conventional wisdom would say you're between 15 and 18,000 for a red line. So if you start there and you start working it backwards, more than likely Yamaha has built that bike with the stroke that they want the 850 to be, and then they're just simply changing the cylinders and the cylinder case and the cases. So a lot of that work that they did, as far as size, layout, positioning of where they want it in the chassis, all that stuff is all still going to work on the 850, and the rough design is still going to be very similar with a small change within reason. I'll call them small changes. Hey, a different cylinder configuration, as in size, and a slightly different head that you're going to have to cast to accommodate that smaller piston, or whichever way Yamaha decided to do it. Right? I don't know what they would do, but my guess is they would use a shorter stroke, which means they'd have to have a larger piston. So that being said, that's how I see it. I don't think they're obviously chucked a bunch of money at it, but then again, I'm sure that Honda's chucking a bunch of money behind the scenes for an 850 development. I'm sure Ducati's chucking buckets of money at doing an 850, and so is Aprilia. So
I remember when the rules came out, Jim, and we did talk about it at the time, although it was obviously quite a while ago. There are some quite prescriptive, obviously, rules in place for these engines because what they were conscious not to happen was what happened in the 800cc era when they were revving massively highly and sort of producing similar power, I guess, to the 990s, but deploying it in a more dangerous way almost. So I'm just having a quick look. I'm not being rude. I'm reading messages. I was Googling what are the rules for 27. So as we know, 1000 to 850, maximum bore is reduced from 81 to 75 mil, but that's a max. Obviously, we've got the 100% sustainable fuel, which will impact power to some extent, I'm
yes.
sure. And okay, there's a reduction in the number of engines that you can have in a season, which will, I suppose, help to quell things as well. So your theory makes an awful lot of sense to me, Jim, that they'll sacrifice next year in the bid to kind of get the 850 as right as they possibly can. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yep. So let's talk about what Quartararo had to say at the post Misano test. He got his first taste of riding the V4, and he immediately comes back and says, "Yep, got the same problems with the V4 that I got with the inline four." Whoa. Not exactly what Yamaha wants to hear from their number one rider, but I mean, this is a completely different departure in what Yamaha has essentially done throughout their entire time. I mean, let's face it, since the 990s, the 990 era, okay, how about this? Let's say it this way, the four-stroke era,
Yeah.
the Yamaha has not built a V engine. It has always been an inline engine, which is what they've wanted to do. And they've been somewhat revolutionary with it, is with the cross-plane crank idea that they have and other things that they did. So, they're kind of known for that. So for them to go the other way and say, "Look, we're going to do it as a V4," they really don't have a huge database to draw from, and they're going to have to spend the money to catch up to the people who have V4s, i.e. KTM, Aprilia, Honda, Ducati. Now, granted, I think we know that the Honda is a 90-degree V, sort of rotated backwards, I guess you could say. Ducati's is a 90-degree, but it's in an L shape, as the first cylinders are basically pretty close to horizontal. I think KTM uses like an 88-degree V to kind of close that up. I don't know what Aprilia is. It's somewhere in there. So the only way you can get, you can put an engine on the dyno, run it forever, right? You can do all these other things, but until you put a rider on it and you test it in the crucible of racing, you have no idea what it's going to do. You can think about what it's going to do. So, I mean, I applaud Yamaha for showing this much gumption to put a bike out and do this and go for it and, try to get all this data, try to figure everything out. And they're obviously going to have to do, with the bore of 75 millimeters, they're obviously going to try, they're trying to build a torquey motor. Because I think what almost all the rider aids are pretty much turned off at that point. I think it's something close or equatable to like the 990 era of the electronic control that they're going to have on these. So a torquey engine is going to be your friend.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really sort of on the fence when it comes to Fabio Quartararo. I mean, I said last episode, I believe, that I consider Fabio, well, I said two aliens in the category at the moment. I suppose arguably it's three with Acosta, although that is still not fully proven yet. Certainly Quartararo is incredible over a single lap, but I'm sure I've kind of maybe sort of read rather than heard commentators saying it out loud, but I'm pretty sure I've heard people sort of poking that accusation that he's maybe not the best development rider out there. Put him on a fast bike and he will be really, really quick. And obviously, we've seen that. He's a world champion for a reason and he's got that many pole positions for a reason. And obviously, he's still conjuring up laps on the inline four this season to get himself on the front row. And he's had a pole or two this year already. So, I mean, he's amazing. I mean, he really is an amazing rider. But as to his development credentials, question mark, he's current world champion in terms of whinging and moaning. And I would have thought Yamaha would be getting a bit peeved with some of it at the moment. So for him to say what he said post-test, I think is a bit off, really, given how much effort Yamaha are putting in and how early in its development phase this new motor and package is. Because obviously it's a new chassis, that everything's different, isn't it? It has to be. You don't just bolt the V4 into the existing package. So yeah, I'm a little bit kind of frustrated on Yamaha's behalf, really, because they're chucking the kitchen sink at it. They're spending gazillions on this, and it just would be nicer to have somebody that's a little bit more on board. I can't see him being at Yamaha beyond the end of next year. I think he's out of contract at the end of 26, and I'd be very surprised if he's riding a Yamaha again, to be perfectly honest. So, I mean, it's a good reason for them to have kept Miller, for one thing. I mean, clearly he is a far inferior qualifier and racer to Quartararo. I don't think that's terribly contentious, but he's a much better development rider and he's got a huge amount of experience, which will come in very usefully for Yamaha. And they're going to need Miller because, I mean, Quattro, and don't even get me started on what that bloody necklace is all about. That is just, well, I don't know what the word is really.
Aerodynamic. I think he's going for the golf ball theory. If you have dimples, you get go faster. That's where I'm leaving it.
I'm not
As we
looking
said,
forward to him falling off the bike because I never look forward to anybody falling off a bike. But when he does inevitably fall off the bike and that thing breaks and the pearls go shattering all over the gravel and he's running around trying to pick them all up, I'll laugh my ass off when that happens. I don't see, well, I just don't get it. Sorry, I'm old
yeah,
fashioned. I just don't get it.
I don't either. But back to Quartararo and his in what he said. I won't deny the development part of it, but what he said after, I his words could have been more censored, more
Diplomatic, I
chosen.
think. Yeah.
Right. If he would have said, hey, the bike's brand new, we have some teething problems, we're going to have to work through those, and we're looking at the data to decide what we're going to try next and which areas that we need to improve, I think is a perfectly fine thing to say.
Yeah.
You could even say, hey, I didn't make as much progress on the bike today as I hoped to because it's new and we're not sure which way to go with settings, and I think maybe we went the wrong way. Any of that is acceptable, but to kind of be like, well, I got the same problems we got with the inline four, it's like,
Yeah.
ooh, that's a bit touchy.
Yeah, that's a kick in the teeth for everybody that's working really hard and not getting paid a fraction of what he's getting paid.
Sure. All right, let's move on in the news back to Moto, continuing with MotoGP news. The Moto E Championship will not continue. It might be on a hiatus, who knows? But the main reason that it's being dropped is citing no interest from the fans as the main reason. And quite honestly, I have no interest in watching an electric motorcycle go around the track. I do not. They did some of the bikes at COTA. They had some e-bikes that were taking people on like that double up ride thing. You can't hear them coming, so you don't know to look because there's no sound. Again, I think it's perfectly fine to have like an electric bike for the city. If you lived in the city, in the inner city, someplace where it's conveniently to be able to charge it. I live out in the country. There's not a place to charge these things. It's not going to be functional for me. I'm old school. I'd like to go back to two strokes of street bikes, but we're never going to have that happen. I understand why.
Yep.
But I thought that the electric, I mean, just like Formula E for cars isn't that great. I don't think anybody's there. Now, the problem, I think, the biggest problem for me to it as a racing motorcycle. Now, I'm not going to deny that the racing and the championships have been close. That's undeniable that that has been good racing and a good championship. It's not contentious, as you've said, Rich, for
Yeah.
that. But the bikes weigh too much because the batteries are so heavy. If you can somehow figure out a way to, reduce the size of the battery, yet still have the same capacity inside of it, that's where they need to go. And I don't think anybody's ready to step up or figure out how to do that yet. Or maybe there's not a way to do it yet, right? I mean, that's a tricky thing to do is store energy. No matter how you do it. Remember, if you think back to the early dawn of the kinetic energy systems that Formula One kind of used, Williams had a flywheel that would continue to spin as it let off the gas, and then that developed energy that stored it in a spinning flywheel that then let the energy back out as the car came out of the corner or whatever. I mean, it's done with subway trains. That's how the way the light's gonna go dim in the subway, and then they catch back up because it's a spinning wheel that they've got. So maybe something like that's a little better, but then there's a whole gyroscopic effect that's gonna be involved in all that. It's just the technology is not mature yet, and I'm not gonna miss not having a Moto E class for sure.
No, I don't want to talk about this too long because I could care less, to be perfectly honest. But I think there are a couple of salient points. The first is, and I accept that I'm a 50-year-old white male. I like heavy metal music. I like blokey things. As far as I am concerned, and I appreciate I'm not necessarily the demographic that the sport is going after, I'm not interested in bikes I can't really hear. I do accept because I have watched some Moto E racing and it has been quite entertaining, but obviously they're very short races because the battery technology hasn't allowed for long format races. And yeah, I need a bit of noise in my life, really. I mean, we were talking pre-show, weren't we, Jim, about trying not to be overtly political, and we've touched on things like net zero and electric vehicles, and they definitely have their place in terms of cars. I get cars more than bikes in a way. I certainly get the inner city kind of mode of transport where it comes to electric scooters and stuff makes total sense to me for a variety of different reasons. But a bike that can't go much more than 100 miles on a charge out on the open road as a performance vehicle just doesn't make any sense. And I think this is the problem with Moto E. It isn't relatable, it isn't transferable at the moment. And that's not to say battery technology won't improve in the future, because obviously it is going to do that. But sport is in essence survival of the fittest, and therefore Moto E just is dead because it can't survive in this world. There's no appetite for it really. And I would add to that that if Dorna or whoever is promoting this, but I guess it falls under Dorna's remit, are really going for that demographic that should get it more than people of our generation, Jim, because we're sort of becoming oldies, then why the hell have they not done a better job at promoting it? Because the promotion of that series has been worse than World Superbike, and that is a low bar already that I'm setting there. So for me, it's no wonder that the hiatus, which as you correctly say, is a sort of a fancy way of saying it's dead. That just kind of puts it on the back burner as to what's going to happen in the future, and it'll just quietly forgotten for a while. I would imagine that's what's going to happen. And parallel to that, no surprise to me that F1 are talking about bringing the V8 back once this next rule set in Formula One shakes through. In fact, they've even been trying to get the manufacturers to sign up to breaking this new turbo hybrid regulation earlier than 2030, I think is when it runs to, or 2031. They've been trying to get V8s back in by 2029, and the manufacturers have quite understandably said, no, we've spent a huge amount of money on these next generation engines, we want to run them. But they can see that there's a problem with this, some of this, and sport for pure sport spectacle, which is what draws punters in, needs a bit of a wow factor. And in bike racing, amongst other things, that is noise. And so for me, it's not a surprise that Moto E's gone, and I've spoken way longer than I intended to on that, but I knew I was going to start ranting, so I apologize.
There's only one way forward, I think, and that is sustainable fuel. I think that is the future. I think that is the way to do it. However you want to call it, carbon neutral, whatever. I don't care.
I totally agree.
The fuel is the way to do it. I mean, honestly, if you really want to do it right, it's a fuel cell or a hydrogen powered vehicle. However, the energy required to do all that, blah, 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 we're not going there. Anyway, moving on. Moving on to the next thing. Let's go dive back to the news. How about that?
Comments welcome from the listeners, of course, on this. As with everything that we talk about, it does stray into politics, but sort of post-woke, I can see the end of some of this nonsense going on. Thank you.
Oh, Misano will remain on the calendar for a further 5 years. I don't think there's any real surprise about that. I think Italy's always going to have two races. There's too much of an Italian contingent there for them to eliminate one of them. So I don't see that happening in the near future. I mean, not in the first, not in 5 years, you know.
Well, ironic that we were both sort of saying that we're not huge fans of modern day Misano. Next to Mugello, obviously they don't even get onto the same page for comparison purposes. But yes, you are right, Jim. There's only two races in Italy, so you can kind of get away with that as opposed to the, what is it, five on the Iberian Peninsula, which clearly is going to have to change in the future.
Into some rider news, the rider market is kind of shaping up. We learned that Piqueras is going to move to Moto2 next year. He will be on the MSI team alongside of Ortola. So that's kind of a shocker move for me. I really didn't see Piqueras moving, but he's got a plan and that's fine and whatever. Hey, more power to you. I think he just fears Keelys. But anyway, maybe.
And the trouble is, you get kind of classified one of those riders that's always in Moto 3. Take Dennis Foggia as a prime example, was in Moto 3 for way too long, left it too late to go to Moto 2, didn't really get on with it, back in Moto 3, and it's kind of game over territory at this point, isn't it? So I think Max, he's obviously much, much younger, and you've got to keep progressing. And if he isn't going to win it this year, like you say, with Keelys, chances are he's going to struggle next year, and he's just better off getting up the class, really, and trying to do better.
Danny Munoz has been confirmed at Italtrans. We had speculated that's where he was going, but it's been confirmed he's there. He's going to run alongside Huertas. Eddie O'Shea is out of a ride in Moto 3. It's cutthroat there, people. Hate to see Eddie out of a ride, but where it is. This one,
Jim, can I just add again, cynic hat on slightly? We know that Michael Lafferty, who is one of the world's busiest people in terms of the amount of interest he has and teams that he runs and et cetera, but that team I think is fairly well known to be not the best funded in the pit lane. And it's obviously done its best to promote British riders, but budget's always an issue. I mean, the signings that he's got going there next year, which I'm hurriedly looking down, I think Adrian Fernandez is one, isn't it? Which I
Yep,
was
that's the
like,
next one.
wow, that was a big surprise to me. And who's the other rider that's going there, Jim? I've got it written down.
Joel
Joel
Kelso and
Kelso.
Adrian Fernandez are going to MLAV Honda next year, which that was shocking, very shocking to me.
Initially, yes. And then I thought, however, that brings some sponsorship money with it, probably. Which is obviously very, very important. So that's the reality of modern day motorsport.
I was I w Fernandez leaving and going there, I'm not overly shocked by. Kelso going there, I am, because it's going to the Honda, which,
Yeah.
I don't know how much effort Honda's going to put into next year's bike, because we know Moto 3 becomes a 500cc twin in 27. If Honda doesn't have, I mean, but Honda being Honda, they're going to be like, no, we're going to build the best Moto 3 bike we can and decimate all just because that's what we do.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. And instead of rules, we will win championships despite whatever rules you want to put at us. I guess I don't know. Maybe that's what's going to happen. I don't know. It was just it's just interesting to me.
I'm just surprised by both of them moving because Kelso had gone back. I forget the name of the team he's in this year.
Level up MTA, I think.
That's it. Thank you. And that was a team that he had some association with earlier in his career, and it was kind of like the son's returning home kind of thing when he went there, and for him to be leaving within, well, after a year, that kind of surprised me a little bit. And certainly Fernandez out of Leopard to MLAV, which is not to say anything bad against MLAV, but I didn't expect a Spaniard of that standing to go there. It's surprising to me, but yeah, I suspect it will do a lot of good to the team in terms of its finances, hopefully. But it's a shame for the British riders because they have a tough enough time as it is. So it's hard to see what the route is really for a lot of the young British guys.
So we do know who's going to be on one of the Leopard bikes. It's going to be Guido Pini because he moves there next year.
Yep.
I don't know who he's partnering with, but that's because I'm not, because it's Fernandez and Almanza, and we know Almanza's going. Where was Almanza going? I don't
I
remember now.
don't know. I've actually got. I thought I was looking at the Moto 3 thing. It's actually the Moto 2 list at the moment. I think Moto 2 is a bit further up in terms of who's going where than Moto 3 is at the moment. So I think there's still a lot of balls in the air with Moto 3. So I'm not sure about Almanza. I mean, he's having one of these kind of weird seasons where he's been brilliant on a couple of occasions, but struggled elsewhere. So I don't know whether he'll stay at Leopard or not.
Yeah, don't know.
But Pini's a good signing. Pini is a
I
really good
do think so,
signing.
yeah.
If they can
I
stop him
do.
crashing, because he's bloody quick, but he does. He needs sort of David Munoz, who's his teammate currently in Moto3, of course. They are sort of out of the same piece of granite, those two, and they both crash a bit too much and a bit wild. But Pini might do well at Leopard, I suspect.
I agree. Well, that wraps up all the news that we have from the weekend. So let's move to the racing and start out with Moto3 qualifying QP1. Lunetta's back after his injuries. He's now back riding again. Carrero, Rossi, Nepa, Carpe. There's your interesting name who shouldn't really be in the Q1, but
Yeah.
he is. O'Shea and Moodley were all there. When it got done, Moodley, Carpe, Lunetta, and Nepa all got out of that session and went into the second session. Almanza was down early on with Pini. I mean, that was a really weird accident. It was like Almanza crashed and sort of, I want to say, is that turn that is between one and two. You've got the, what is that, a left to the right. And somewhere in there, it looked like Almanza just sort of too much gas and spun the bike out. And then so that caused the bike to spin towards the outside of the track, which then caused the bike to be hit by the other riders there. And everybody took avoiding action, sort of fell on the gravel. It was really kind of just, it was weird. It was just a weird crash. It was, you don't really see these kind of things too much in qualifying, but this time we did. Halfway through is Pironi, Munoz, Rolstein, Rueda, Ferrusato, and Kelso. Munoz, Rueda, Yamanaka, and Pironi, and Rolstein and Ferrusato were now, with 2 minutes to play, were there. Munoz was sitting in the pits at this point. And I'm like, what? You think that you got a time that's good enough? This is Moto 3. Crazy things happened at the very last bit of it, but it was so happened that Pironi would go to pole, Kelso would go next, Rolstein would be third, Rueda would be fourth. So Munoz, having not been out on the track, goes from being on pole position to starting fifth.
Yeah.
I don't know if they didn't fuel the bike enough or what. I don't know. I don't really have an answer for why he wasn't out there, but it's Moto 3.
Consistently tried and failed to figure out what the hell the Moto3 teams do when it comes to qualifying.
Yeah, Fernandez would be sixth, then Ferrusato, Yamanaka, Keelys qualified in ninth. Carpe, Piqueras then in 11th, then Foggia at 12th. All right, so we come back on Sunday morning. We got 20 laps around the Misano circuit. San Marino, Marco Simoncelli World Circuit or something to that nature.
That's correct.
Anyway,
Yeah.
I think it's like the longest name for a track of any of the tracks. I know
Yeah.
it's a lot of words and letters and stuff that are all in there. Kelso had a great start, and after a bit of a back and forth around the outsides of turns one and two, he would lead. It was when Pironi would go ahead and lead. So it was a great little battle there the first few turns. It was different for Kelso because there was a bit of a fight back. Sometimes there has been people who have said, team managers have said, his own manager has said that he's not been aggressive enough at certain times. So it was interesting to see him sort of battling it out as they took to the start. Kelso did recover to be first, followed by Pironi, Munoz, Rolstein, Rueda, and Carpe. Munoz went from fifth to second within the first couple of laps, which was wildly crazy. I mean, he simply was just passing everyone and anybody. It just didn't seem to matter. Typical Munoz style, right? It's elbows out and we're going to the front. Doesn't matter where I qualify. With five laps in, Kelso, Rueda, Perez, Munoz, Fernandez, and Kelis are there. Now, Rueda would go to second on a very strong move at turn one to turn two on Pironi. I mean, he was a long way back, really outbroke him. Didn't know if he was going to get a turn. He did. It was a great move. Great move by Rueda to get there. Munoz was then on the inside curb, and he wound up touching Pironi, and then he was off and into the gravel at turn four. So as they go to turn four, Munoz is trying to go up the inside. Pironi's on the outside. Pironi comes down, clips the front end, Munoz into the gravel trap. Did you see when he tumbled into that gravel? Did you see when they picked Munoz's bike back up? All the gravel that came out of the upper part of the fairing, like where the air intake is, it was a huge pile come pouring out of that thing.
I don't remember seeing him actually crash in the gravel. Did he? He actually went down, did he?
Yeah, I believe he went down into the gravel and quickly had the bike back up, and
Okay.
then you had the, I mean, it was just one of the things. He just rode off and you got into the deep gravel and kind of just fell over and then, quickly got back up, as I
Yeah, but
recall.
I don't recall seeing that. But because there was quite a lot of issues with the coverage over the weekend, which we might sort of touch on a little bit later on. There were some technical issues, which meant that a lot of people didn't get to see replays of stuff.
Okay, we'll hold that
I
for the
remember
end. How
the
about that?
incident that caused him and Pironi, yeah,
Bernie, yes.
to sort of go off at that corner. But yeah, I can't say that I remember seeing Munoz go down. But anyway, yeah, it's amazing how much gravel they pick up and then
Oh,
distribute
crazy.
all over the track. Yeah.
Yep, Rueda would get by Kelso at turn eight, and Kelis was trying to catch the front two. So Kelis is coming on. I'm like, the kid's coming. Well, this is going to be interesting. By lap 10, Rueda, Kelso, Kelis, who is dragging the following pack to the front. Whoever was behind Kelis was just coming along for the ride because Kelis was going to the front. I mean, it was kind of impressive because the front two had like a second or a second and a half, which that's a pretty big gap that you get. I mean, I don't know if it was a second and a half. I'm sure it was like a second, but that's a pretty big gap by Moto3 standards to have. Kelis would get by Kelso, and then Kelso would go back by Kelis. And then Kelis wound up getting a track limits warning. Well, okay, that's kind of normal for Kelis. I mean, what race hasn't he gotten a track limits warning? That kid is using every millimeter of the track and just a millimeter more too much. But I mean, that's where it's fast, that's for sure. Pironi was by Kelis then at turn four. So Pironi and them are having this great little battle. There was good battles like up and down the entire pack, Rich. It was just fascinating to see. And see what was going on. With 15 laps in the book, Rueda was leading over Pironi, then Kelso, then Kelis, and then it was Fernandez and Piqueras who are starting to fall off the end of it. It was becoming a four-rider battle for the lead as those two guys start to fall off a little bit. But then Kelis got by Kelso to get into third place on that lap as well. Four to go, and Kelis was flirting with a long lap penalty because he was over the curbs on the absolute ragged edge. I mean, there's the spot where you're allowed to run wide at the very last turn because that's a green surface. No, sorry, that's blue.
Blue.
Blue is okay. Blue is okay. That's so backwards. We've had that rant. We're not doing it again. But he's on the blue, and then as he comes by, you got to get back on the curb because there's a smidgen of green that you're not allowed to touch. And I tell you, some of the pictures show it looks literally like Keeley's rear tire is no more than a millimeter away from that green. And I'm just thinking, dude, no, I don't need you having a long lap because I think it's going to ruin the race if you have to go get that long lap penalty there. Four to go, and Keelys is flirting with this long lap penalty as we were talking about. Lynetta was down at the at Canova, or what do they call it? Is it Cavone? Cavone, the
Devono.
turn 11.
Yeah.
I believe it's called Cavone. That was a fast crash. I mean, that's wide open on a Moto3 bike.
Yeah.
But luckily, he was rolled around and was able to get back up and everything was okay. Almanza had actually hit his bike and somehow managed to actually stay on the bike, which was absolutely wild because Lunetta had low separated from the bike, right? So when he separated, his trajectory goes off of a tangent due to the centripetal force of where he hits the pavement. The bike kind of goes forward because it has more momentum than him and goes spinning around. And it's like poor old Almanza kind of threads it between where Lunetta is and where the bike's going. And the bike kind of then pivots around and just nips it. And he wiggles, and I'm like, that's going to the gravel, and this is going to be absolutely massive. And somehow got it back under control and went in. I mean, I would almost call that save of the year. It was quite impressive. I mean, I flinched. How about you?
Yeah, that's not a place you want to be getting caught up in an accident like that. And as you say, Jim, Linetta was lucky not to get hit there because Tomizawa, was it, some years back in Moto2, had that same crash there and lost his life as a result because he got clipped by another rider completely blamelessly, obviously, at those speeds. But that's a nasty place to go down, Cavone, because that is one of the, well, it's the quickest turn on the track, and I'd venture probably one of the quickest turns all year long.
Yeah, I was wondering if somewhere on PI might, like turn one at PI might be
Possibly, yeah. Hey,
maybe
Shed. Yeah, it's very, very quick.
super quick. Oh, with three to go, Pironi gets by Rueda, and it's a melee at that point. You don't know because somebody's going up the inside of somebody and somebody's going somewhere. It's like, okay, this is pure Moto 3. It's like, well, this is what you want to see. Because it's like they're really going after each other. Keelys would get by Pironi at one. He did it around the outside to take it back. But Keelys came from so far back on the brakes, which reminded me of one Mr. P. Acosta, because that's how he did it on a Moto3 bike. It's
Yeah.
scary how similar Keelys rides a Moto3 bike to Acosta. If you watch, the similarity is very close. It's really tight entries, really late on the brakes, somehow pivots the bike in the middle and squirts and goes back out again. It was fascinating to watch that sequence of events because Keelys is riding the wheels off of the bike. This kid has some serious talent, and it's pretty evident that he is probably the front runner to win the Moto3 title next year if he stays in the class.
It's funny though, Jim, isn't it? Because, I mean, okay, as we've said many times, Keelys has not competed in all of the rounds this year because of his age prevented him from starting the season. Rueda is the runaway leader, but the guy we're talking about is Keelys, and it's because of his all-action style, isn't it? And I remember when Pedro was kind of ripping the field up in Moto3, we constantly talked about almost redefining the way to ride a Moto3 bike. Extreme sort of Honda Marquez kind of front end, getting the rear out, everything on the front. And Keelys does feel a little bit like that. I mean, I don't recall us ever talking about David Alonso last year being like that. He was a bit more kind of in control in the sense of it looked a bit more Rueda-ish, I suppose, for Alonso, as I recall. I mean, I may be wrong, but Keelys is definitely all action, and as you say, he uses every last little bit of curb. Yes, he's going to be fun to watch next year with a full season to go at it. Yeah.
So the final lap, Pironi blows it at turn 11. He's wide. Rueda gets by Keelys at the last turn. And so Rueda wins the race, just beats Keelys. Then it's Adrian Fernandez snuck in to get third, which, we're not talking about that at all because the action at the front's just so good that here comes Fernandez. Then Kelso was fourth, Piqueras fifth, Pironi would be sixth. Munoz seventh after getting back on the track. Maybe he didn't fall. Maybe it was somebody else. Maybe it was qualifying or something that I have that confused with, Rich.
I'd need to go back and check.
We have to go back and check on that one. But He was definitely in the gravel. Let's put it that way. So then Yamanaka is a thin Pini Carpe Rollstone who went backwards the whole time. Furisato could not make anything work. I mean, usually you're ready for Furisato to be there at the end somehow. I mean, you don't think it's going to be Fernandez. If anybody, you're going to think it's going to be Furisato, right? Then Foggia, who, man, that was just a terrible. Like, he was nowhere to be found. I mean, he winds up, he's 13th. Then Almanza, 14th. Well, he had the off with Lunetta, right? And Scott Ogden got the final world championship point there in 15th. Quickly, if we look at the world championship, Rueda is still leading. He's got a 295 points. Piqueras slips into second place. He's on 217. That puts him 78 behind Rueda. So still a lot to play for. It's you know, I think you could say Rueda's got like maybe a pinky on the world title, kind
Oh,
of.
yeah.
But the man of the hour is Kiles. He's third on 188 points. Now he's 107 behind Rueda, and anything is possible, right? But he's only 29 behind Piqueras for second in the world championship. That's
Yeah.
nothing.
And Piqueras has sort of got such weirdly up and down form as well. That's whereas Quiles is much more consistent. I mean, he has crashed a few times, it's true. Whereas Piqueras is having a weird season where he's either like launching it on the last lap and getting a brilliant win, or he's just kind of bogged down, as indeed was the case in Misano last weekend. You knew with sort of 5, 10 laps remaining that he was basically out of the fight, so he just didn't have what the other guys had up the front. So it's, yeah, a bit troubling, really.
Yeah, there's a couple more wins in Piqueras' future this year yet.
I
I
think
firmly
so.
believe
Yeah,
that.
because when he's on it, he's brilliant, but he's just had a few too many rounds where he's been off it, and that is reflected in the points.
I feel like Kiles in his braking style is well suited to the Motegi track. I would not be surprised if Piqueras wins in Motegi. I wouldn't be
Yeah.
surprised if Kiles wins in Portimão. I wouldn't be surprised if he wins in Valencia. So those three, I'm almost picking it right now. He's going to take this. I don't think he's going to catch Rueda unless Rueda does something really stupid, and I just don't see the kid doing that.
Yeah.
So
And I think we have to say that, I mean, it was a really solid win from Rueda after a couple of, by his
iffy.
standards this year, slightly iffy rounds where I won't say he was lucky to finish as high as he did, because I think he had, what was it, a fourth stroke fifth type positions in Austria and wherever else it was, which were kind of championship winning rides. He got himself where he needed to by the end and scored good points after looking like he was going to have, really quite poor point hauls at those rounds. So, and then to sort of fire back and, I mean, he only just beat Quiles, it's true, but he won. And that's all that counts, all that matters at the end of the day. So, really strong ride. And as we said, Kilo has crashed a little bit of late, and Piqueras is just too up and down. So, I just, oh, 78 points is insurmountable, I think.
Yeah. After Kiles, Munoz is fourth, then Carpe, Kelso, Fernandez, Pironi, Furisato, and then Yamanaka in the top 10. That takes us to the Moto2 scene and Moto2 qualifying on Saturday. So, in the first one is Canet, Sasaki, Munoz, Ortola, Arbolino, Ramirez, and Roberts. And Vire is in there. So, you know, the guys who seem to do great last weekend, Vire, he's in the first session. Canet's still there. This is becoming a common occurrence with Canet being in the first one. And then you sort of got like Arbolino's kind of there normally, right? Munoz, after the really great weekend, comes here and he's in there. So it's like, wow, that's really sort of flip-flopped and messed up or whatever. But Arbolino, Canet, Munoz, Sasaki all get through. Those are the four guys that get out of that first qualifying session. We get into the second qualifying session. We find like halfway through Arbolino, Moreira, Gonzalez, Holgado. They're the guys that are at the first four. And 3 minutes to go, it was really starting to hot up. Like there's red helmets kind of going every which way, and you're not sure what's really the yellow flag that's in sector two. And I'm like, well, okay, is that really gonna cause a problem because Zonta van de Gerberg had crashed in turn eight? So I was like, well, where is everybody? Because you're trying to look at the little map, right? You know, you're trying to figure out are the fast guys ahead of that, or is there going to be a lap disqualified because they didn't slow down? And it got really kind of weird out of there. But it came out with Holgado, Gonzalez, Canet, Aegis, Vietti, and Arbolino. Then Jake Dixon crashed at turn six, which kind of shuffled things to where Holgado held on to his pole position. Vietti would start second, then Gonzalez. I mean, sort of finally recovering some of the form that Gonzalez has been missing. You know, obviously he had that bike with the whole radiator and all that, but he hasn't really been doing that great. I mean, even Barcelona, he didn't look fantastic. So it's kind of good to see him at least be on the front row now, kind of riding the ship, if you will. Then it was Barry Baltus, Kennet, Morera, which is that's pretty far down from Morera. Then Aegis Arbolino, that's a pretty good qualifying for Arbolino. Then Dixon, but that's a result of the crash because Dixon had red helmets when he went down. Then Arenas Alonso, who we know can't really get anything out of the tires in qualifying, but I thought he could have pulled a little bit better magic out of that because he was not in that first session, right? Alonso had made it to the second one. So for him to be that low, I thought was interesting as well. And Sasaki was 12th. So there's your qualifying. Now, that takes us into the race. We're going to go 22 laps around this with this. This one, Rich, it's not one to write home about. It's not, you're not writing letters back home like how great it was. And hi, Mom. Things in Misano were great. The racing was spectacular, except for Moto2, which was really, that's kind of how that one's going on. There's really not a whole lot that gets into this one, but
This is not on the list of races to watch back over the winter break, put it that way.
yes, definitely not. Vietti got a great hole shot. He got ahead of Holgado, Morera, Gonzalez, and Aegis, and Baltus. Dixon got shoved out wide and was dropped all the way down to 16th. Kennet basically gated at 9th, right? To use a little bit of a speedway term there. With 5 laps in, Vietti was out front, followed by Hurtado, then Morera and Gonzalez. Now those two are kind of battling each other because Morera had gotten the jump on Gonzalez, right? Like, from where Morera qualified, I think like 10th, for him to get up there and challenge Gonzalez was pretty amazing. So, but anytime Gonzalez would kind of get by, guess what? Morera goes back by, right? He's got that. He has a very much a severe case of Troy Bayliss, right? If you pass me, I will pass you right back, kind of a thing going on. And they're going back and forth. Like that battle is like the really good battle. They're really, really, really battling on each other. But the problem is that allows the two guys out front, who are Vietti and Holgado, they're like, I got a second and a half lead 9 laps into the race. Holgado would wind up getting a track limits warning. Again, it's like, it's pretty much you get the question of like, well, who isn't getting a track limits warning around here and all that. Now, Morera and Gonzalez finally wound up being joined by Baltus and Aegis. So you sort of had that gap between Morera and Gonzalez, and that was Aegis and Baltus. Now, Baltus, from the very first couple of laps, or first sessions, I should say, of the weekend, had race pace. Like everybody said, Baltus had race pace, race pace, race pace, race pace. And it looked like maybe that was going to be that way because they had caught them pretty quick. And it was going to be interesting to see what was going to happen right there. Finally, 13 laps to go, Baltus got by, or 13 laps in, I'm sorry. That timing scoring pylon thing switching back, I can't handle that. So anyway, Baltus got by Gonzalez finally got by Morera, okay? But Baltus also got by too because it took a very vicious move by Gonzalez to get rid of Morera. And it opened the door for Baltus to come through too, which is not exactly what Gonzalez wanted to have happen. But Gonzalez needed to get by Morera. That there was no question Morera was keeping him from being at the front. And Gonzalez, I think, maybe was riding a little too patient, a little too cautious. And I think he finally got it together. He made a good pass. He made a block pass, and it just left the door open for Baltus to come along with him. But then Baltus immediately got by Gonzalez. So all the work Morera did to get the place gets taken away by the fact that Baltus has got serious pace, and he's going there. The question was, could Baltus do anything with anybody else? That's kind of where the question is, because that's all you're really looking for. Morera starts to go backwards at this point, because Aegis even gets by. Aegis gets a track limits warning. At 5 to go, Holgado has cooked his tires, and Baltus may be able to get to second because Vietti was gone. Let's face it, Vietti is like a San Marino specialist. He's won there like how many times in a row now? Is this like three, four, something like that? It's crazy how many he's won in a row.
He has won a lot there, and it always brings up this kind of home advantage or track knowledge kind of argument. Because bear in mind, he's on the Bosque Scura chassis, which has probably not been the bike to be on for the most part this year. And then suddenly he turns up at Misano, and he's kind of untouchable. I find it a bit kind of, well, intriguing, I suppose, is one way of putting it, and a bit baffling, kind of in another way, that he can't make it work quite so well elsewhere. Weird. And he's re-signed, I think, in that team as well, Jim, just in terms of another bit of news. So we'll get to see him win at Misano again next year.
Yeah, for sure. Baltus gets by Helgado because now our attention is sort of like at the front, because it's like where can Baltus go in all this? Now Aegis are by Gonzalez. Gonzalez had gone way too hot into turn one. He was wide. That allowed those two guys to get back by. Then Aegis goes wide with a couple laps to go, and then Moreira and Gonzalez get Aegis. The race finishes with Vietti winning, home track advantage, all that stuff. Baltus was second. Great ride. I mean, Baltus has put in some absolutely fantastic rides this year.
Yeah.
And this is another great one. I mean, this is kind of why you were watching this one, is just to kind of figure out where Baltus was going to be. I felt bad for Holgado. He didn't get a second. You know, he had to win, and then he's here, and then he gets third. You know, it's like it's still on the podium, right? Then Moreira, Aegis, Gonzalez, Canet, then Alonso made it to eighth. Then Arbolino, Guevara, Arenas, Munoz, who was a standout sensation in Catalonia, now comes in 12th. Then Arturo Sasaki and Alonso Lopez. As we look at the championship, well, Gonzalez is on 227 points now. He's 39 ahead of Moreira. Moreira really needed to be farther up in this battle. You know, he needed to be winning races, I think, to make this closer. So he's 39 behind. Canet is now tied with Moreira, which shows you how misfortunate it was for Moreira as terms of the points that he did, because Canet was nowhere to be found, basically. Baltus increases his points total to 173. Then Jake Dixon is now fifth. Then Vietti with the win is sixth. Then Holgado seventh. Aegis ninth. Arenas ninth. Aegis eighth. Arenas ninth. And then Anshu has fallen all the way down now to 10th because he's injured and not capable of being riding. Not the greatest Moto2 race ever, Rich, for sure. Any
Definitely
thoughts that
not.
you want to add to that?
Well, as you said, Jim, I mean, the main point of interest, well, I suppose there were two. I kind of have the feeling there's a bit of, well, I suppose friendly needles, an oxymoron. There's a bit of needle, I suspect, between Gonzalez and Moreira over the whole MotoGP graduation thing. Although I'm pretty sure Moreira still isn't officially confirmed at LCR yet. I'm kind of curious why that news hasn't happened yet, but I think that. Is oh, do you know something?
I think it's Motegi. I think they want to announce it in Japan. That's my person. That's a
That would make
personal
sense.
take. That's where I'm going with it.
Yeah, well, let's say we'll be very surprised if it doesn't get announced there. And I think Gonzalez can feel somewhat rightly aggrieved to have been sort of passed over for MotoGP, given that, I mean, 39 points is not a massive lead, and there's still a good few races to go, but. Again, he's a bit like Rueda, isn't he, Gonzalez? He just keeps chalking up the points. And he's won a bunch of races as well. So, I mean, he'll be a deserving Moto2 champion of that, there's no doubt. But he's the guy that's kind of not going up to MotoGP, which does seem a little bit unjust. But the main point of interest for me, as you've already indicated, was Barry Baltus, really. And if he'd had another two or three laps, that would have been a spicy battle with Vietti. We don't know what Vietti had left if he'd been looking after his tires a little bit. But Baltus is really good on used tires, isn't he? He really likes, you can see the way he rides, he likes the bike really loose. So, in that sense, a lower grip kind of end of race kind of situation is obviously a sweet spot for him. And it's a shame he didn't get by into second a little bit earlier, really, because. You know, another lap or two, I think he would have been right on him because he closed in massively quickly, didn't he? He must have gobbled up 4 or 5 seconds from the point in which he got into second, and he was what, well within a second of Vietti at the end. So, yeah, it was a shame that that didn't turn an otherwise pretty turgid affair into something with a bit of excitement at the end. But there you go. I mean, we see this with Moto2 from time to time, and it's been overall a pretty good championship this year.
Yeah, we can't complain. The racing's been pretty good. Oh, let's move to MotoGP. And that first qualifying session, Zarco, Quartararo, Binder, Vinales. And that's expected. Vinales is still trying to get some strength back in his shoulder from the accident that he had. Bastianini, and Audiger are in there. Now, Binder had would be on his second bike again because he had chain issues on his prime bike. It's like, that's a weird thing to have. I mean, it's possible, right? I mean, occasionally these things do happen, and it was just odd that it happened to Binder. And they said how he'd been like slipping on the sprocket, which that's really weird to do. I mean, not impossible, right? I've really have only ever seen chains slip on a sprocket when the sprocket is worn where the teeth are curved over into the direction of rotation of the rear tire. And then it kind of goes that way. But that seemed, come on, that's really obvious to see. I can't imagine the factory guys at KTM are going to go, oh yeah, we're going to run that sprocket or.
So I think it's a brand new one every session, probably.
I would think so. I mean, there's, I'm sure there's the certain amount of kilometers that they know it can successfully go, and things are getting changed as they do that, right? I mean, we learned the hard way when we started road racing that as dirt track, right? We would use a chain and a master link, and you had that clip that goes around the master link and holds your chain in place. That doesn't work in a road racer. It will produce enough torque that it will spread the clip. And it'll toss it off. So you have to buy a riveted type of master link where you actually are deforming or mushrooming the cylindrical part that goes through the chain to couple it together so it cannot come back apart again, which is kind of crazy, but that's sort of how it goes. Anyway, I just thought it was interesting that they had this issue. And I kind of bring it up because I'm foreshadowing what happens later on Sunday. Either way, halfway through, Quartararo has set a track record, and he is in first. Audinger is then behind him, then Binder, then Fernandez, Iger, and Rins. Now, Bastianini is down at turn 15. It looked like he had no temp in the front. It just completely mid-corner, which should be off throttle, if not maybe starting to slightly pick up the throttle. And there shouldn't really have been a lot of weight to cause a push condition at that point. And you're because at that point you're trying to steer the bike off the corner with the rear, and poof, down he went off there. And I was like, wow, that's really, really wild. Either way, Quartararo, who had another really good lap going, got scrubbed because of track limits. But Quartararo and Audinger got out of that session. We were getting dangerously close to the 90-second mark around Misano, so it was like, well, maybe we could get there in the second qualifying. Who knows, right? So they kind of laid this out. I'll talk about that before the sprint. Let's just get through qualifying. Let's see. Alex was looking really good. He was followed by Bez and then Acosta and then Marrera and Bagnaia, then Digia and then Mark. Now, Mark was way down. He had turned his first lap. It was a pretty good lap. It was a really good like 130 low 131. And then he kind of went to the pits like almost immediately while everybody else was taking like another lap. And these guys all sort of went ahead of Mark, and you're like, ooh, this is kind of really weird. This is not a Mark Marquez kind of thing, but perhaps maybe the tire didn't feel right to him, or there was something in the bike that he wanted to change. There's all these different possibilities that kind of are floating out there, but like, okay, well, let's see what's going on. Pecco got turn one just completely wrong. I mean, it was 8 ways of separation of bike and back and forth, and it was. Bagnaia is that late breaker, very calm man, back tire off the ground, right into the corner, flip it in. And it was, this is just wiggling and just going every which way. It's horrifying to watch how bad.
He just can't stop the bike, Jim, can he? He just
No.
cannot get the thing stopped in the way that he wants. And you kind of wonder now whether it's so bad. Well, either goes barreling in and just it doesn't stop, or he's going in so slow as so as not to crash that the lap time's not there. I mean, this is his problem. He just that sweet spot that he had last year has completely vanished. And I mean, we keep saying it every time we talk, talk about a man who's got completely out of ideas now in terms of what to do. And I'm jumping forward a little bit, but I was listening to the race MotoGP podcast earlier on, and for the first time in a long time, Bagnaia didn't turn up to the, admittedly the Sunday, but I think it was a Sunday, the post-race debriefs, the media scrums. That tells you that there's some heavy conversations going on down in the pit box.
I can't imagine Bagnaia being on a Ducati much longer. They would really have to change things next year, and I don't think they can make it better for him. Not when the other guy in the other on the same bike is winning races at record pace, you know.
I mean, it must be said, I did watch some of the Friday running. I mean, I was at work, people, but I had it sort of in the little thumbnail down in the bottom of the corner quietly. And it's one of the advantages of working for yourself, you can get away with these things. And I have to say that Mark and the Ducati, like several other bikes in actual fact, look a little bit kind of uncomfortable during the weekend, a bit sort of twitchy, not entirely kind of bedded in setup wise, but obviously Pecco's on a whole other level of discomfort when it comes to the bike at the moment. And as you say, Jim, I just part of me just wishes kind of Martin was on the other red bike this year, if that, you know, in this alternative universe where this is playing out, probably. I'd love to see how that competition is going, just to see how good Martin would have been on that bike on the 25, well, 24/25, whatever it is. Because we just don't know over the last couple of seasons how good Bagnaia and Martin really were compared with a fully fit, on a good bike, Marc Márquez, who's making everybody look a bit silly this year, even on an off weekend, which he certainly had this weekend.
Yes, I mean, Bagnaia's was even in the test, they were swapping between 24 and 25 chassis trying to find something. And he was, I saw this from Simon Patterson. So I'm stealing Simon Patterson's words here. He says, hey, Bagnaia being at the top of the timesheets at some point in the tests on that Monday or whatever was not the best thing that could ever happen to him because he'll go to Bateghi and be in complete and total bewilderment as to where it all went. And I'm like, that's really true. It's so sad to see Bagnaia be so lost. I've seen people who have been champions who get on a different bike, or not on a different bike, but get on next year's bike, and it doesn't work, right? Because they change something and it doesn't work. And it takes them four or five, six races to figure it out, but then they figure it out and then they're at the front. But I cannot remember, and please, if anybody can think of an exception to this, please tell me because I want to know. I cannot think of anybody who has been a past champion, top caliber rider struggle so bad on the next year's bike as Bagnaia has throughout this entire season. Rich, give me one.
Kenny Roberts Jr. won the championship in 99, was
2000.
it? Or 2000. And I don't think he won a race the following year on the Suzuki. Still two
Yeah,
strokes, obviously.
right. Okay, I'll give you that one.
I mean, that would be a
That would be close,
comparable
but that's a
one.
difference. That was a different scenario because Kenny Roberts Jr. had won the championship. They were barely had enough parts to keep that bike running. Suzuki put nothing into the bike that next year, and he was like, I'm not pushing this bike because I'm never going to get it, be competitive on it. Rossi had stole the march with, last year of the two strokes, and what's Honda's going to build a bike that's going to decimate you because that's what they
No, all of
do.
that is
But
true.
you're right. You are right.
That would be in recent memory. Well, you're saying that as 20 odd years ago, but that would be the only one that immediately springs to my mind. Nicky Hayden, 2006, 2007, 990 to 800 switch because the Honda got that bike badly wrong.
But I mean, but that, I'll give you that one. That
But I
one.
think Bagnaia's situation, given the consistency of where he's at as a rider in terms of same team, same bike, it's an evolution. Obviously, it's changed a bit. I mean, Nicky Hayden was going from a 990 to an 800cc. It was a completely different bike. And as you say, with the Suzuki thing, Suzuki were throwing all of their effort into the 990 as it was going to be a couple of seasons later. And Kenny Jr., I think, has even said himself he was not prepared to push beyond the limit and hurt himself in the process, particularly on a two stroke, because they were vicious. Vicious things, even by then.
With Hayden, I'll say Pedrosa was just as equally miserable on that
It,
800
absolutely, that
Honda.
bike was a
So
dog.
this for Bagnaia is the guy on the same motorcycle you have is winning and winning lots of races. So it's a little different, but those are all good off the top of your head scenarios of that. Anyway, we must continue with qualifying. Marquez was on a massive hot lap. He was red everywhere. And the guy behind him, Pedro Acosta, who promptly falls. How many times have we seen this from Acosta? Get out there, get behind Marquez, and crash, or get out there and crash regardless because you are pushing the bike too far. What's going on with Acosta? Because this is becoming a worrying, I can't talk either, Rich. A worrying trend where he's got a bike that I'm going to call decent slash podium capable. He just needs to qualify in a good spot, and he throws it away. Just throws it away. We saw it in Austria. Almost, I mean, he almost threw away big time there. We here and here he did put it on the ground. It's just weird. I don't know if it's a concentration thing or it's a pushing thing or what it's got, but you got any theories?
Well, I'm trying to make excuses for him now. I'm
Okay.
just wondering if he's doing what Mark used to do on the Honda, which is finding the limit of the bike in practice, ideally in practice, not in qualifying. Because I think Acosta is a although he's had quite a few tumbles in races this year, I'm going to sort of unprove my own theory now. But I think in general, Acosta is a better racer than one lap person, I think. I mean, there's, we don't have a huge data set to work on in MotoGP because he's not been around all that long compared to many of them. I think he's just overriding the bike because the bike is certainly improved a lot in the last sort of few rounds, without a doubt. But it's not a Ducati and it's not an Aprilia, so I think he's having to push it to places that it doesn't really want to go. So I'm kind of letting him off on that one. If he was on a more sort of inverted commas dominant bike and he was crashing this much, I don't think that would be excusable. But I think we can kind of give him a bit of a let at the moment because he's. I mean, well, it's tricky with KTM. I mean, Brad Binder has sort of consistently underperformed compared to where we would expect him to be. Vinales was a standout early part of the season. He's injured. Bastianini's kind of had some changes to the bike that he's been waiting for all season and suddenly has been doing much better, although not this weekend, although there's a point about that which we must return to. But through it all, Pedro's kind of been kind of there or thereabouts, and more often than not has been, certainly recently, has been the one that looks the most likely to get a podium out of it. But yeah, but he's crashing a fair bit as well, testing the edges of the limits of the bike. I mean, but that's what the best ones always do, isn't it?
True. Meanwhile, as Marquez was on that hot lap only got him to second place. He lost it all in the three fast right-handers that sort of end or at the end of the lap. Was that like 11, 12, and 13?
Well, it's that Cavone, that horrendously
Yeah.
fast turn on the back straight, and that, yeah.
It was just interesting that he was there. But Quartararo would claim a spot in second, and then Bez would jump to pole. So as it turned out, Bezzecchi on pole position from the home crowd on an Italian bike, the whole nine yards there,
Yep.
followed by Alex Marquez, who would clip Quartararo for second, putting Fabio third, then Mark would start fourth, then Morbidelli, Luca Marini on the Honda in sixth. Very, very good showing. Again, I think you're talking about Spalding saying how Honda is the dark horse to win a championship next year. I'm seriously in line with this, given how good Marini's qualifying has been. Then DiGiantonio Bagnaia would be eighth. Acosta, because he'd fallen, was ninth. And then Fermín Ødegaard would be the final top 10. Of note, Jorge Martín would be 11th on the grid. So we go into the sprint. Now, Bez is going on the outside of Alex as they go through that turn 1-2 complex, and Bez leads. Mark was on the outside of Alex, and then he winds up becoming second as they get to turn 3. So Mark gets from fourth to second. Bez goes, from pole, even though Alex had probably the better start. He rides around it to lead the sprint. So it's Bez, it's Mark, it's Digia and Morbidelli. Now, not a whole lot is going on in this sprint. Five laps in, it's still Bez. He's still leading, still ahead of Mark, still ahead of Alex, and then Quartararo, who falls at turn 2. Quartararo could not make. Quartararo was mad at himself. It was a stupid mistake. I don't know if he just picked the throttle up just a smidge too soon to try to stay with the bikes in front, but he wound up, kissing the pavement and smacking with his hand, and total disgust, gets back up and like. Well, go at it again tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
See, Mark did get by Bez at turn 6, which was pretty impressive pass. Mark always has done well in that turn 6 area of the track. But then Mark would fall at turn 15, and I want to take a moment and talk about the fans, because they in the Dorna feed, Mark goes down, he's in the gravel trap. Now, Mark did slide across the gravel, sort of Superman style, hands out in front, and his head does bump into a tire barrier. There is no air fence, so it wasn't a very hard hit. And obviously, Mark was not hurt at all by this, but that was scary because going head first into that can't be good. Just compression on your spine and any numerous things that can happen to you. Hopefully, next year there will be an air fence there in front of that barrier. But the fans' reaction to Mark falling off. It was the middles being displayed, cheering. I mean, a huge cheer that you could hear on TV had come up. And I'm like, that is completely wrong. I get it. You don't like Mark Marquez because he's winning all the races. I understand. People hated Schumacher when Schumacher was winning everything in Formula One. People hate Max when Max was winning everything in Formula One. But nobody hated him four straight titles, and nobody could really beat him. I mean, Doohan came close to having perfect seasons. He'd lose one, maybe two races. And what was there, only 10 or 12, you know? But I think it's completely uncalled for. You could not like Marc Marquez, but you don't have to display that, nor do you cheer when he falls off into the gravel trap. I think that's completely wrong. That's not being a fan of the sport at all. I mean, I think it's wrong. I think their attitude was wrong. And I think Matt Oxley had the best quote: those people can just bugger off, but he didn't use bugger.
I'm a little bit more on the fence on this one. I mean, first of all, I'll just say I don't like fans cheering when somebody goes down. I mean, Mark was up on his feet fairly quickly, so although he did go in head first, Jim, I mean, he's quite right, and he went in fairly hard. I mean, I wouldn't want to go into barrier head first at that speed. So, I mean, there is that. You know, I get the partisanship, but given that Mark's leading championship on a Ducati, I would have thought there might have been a little bit more goodwill developing towards him, but clearly Malaysia 20, what year was that?
15.
2015.
I'm going with 2015 until told otherwise.
It still casts a long shadow. I mean, that's the only thing I can put it down to. And I mean, another journalist has pointed out, I think quite sort of sensibly or genuinely, that the camera immediately cut to Valentino Rossi, who was trackside as well. Now, why did it do that?
We want to see Rossi's reaction
They're
to it,
playing
right?
up this animosity and trying to still get some mileage out of it, and I just don't think that's a good idea. Or to be honest with you, I don't think it's necessary, because I mean, I like a bit of needle in the sport. I think it helps a little bit with the kind of the pantomime and the theatre of it, within reason. But I mean, for goodness sake, I mean, Ross has been retired now for quite a while, and as we've often said, and I will never be argued against on this, I mean, Rossi hung around 2 or 3 seasons longer than he should have done anyway, particularly by the time he was on the Petronas bike. So, without going down that particular rabbit hole, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it was a bit sort of unedifying to see. I kind of understand it, but it doesn't help when the coverage is still doing its level best to amp up that animosity. Some of the journalists get a bit kind of over the top about it, in my opinion. I mean, if Mark had been sort of buried in the barrier for a minute or two, and people were cheering and they were showing coverage of that, then as far as I'm concerned, that's just totally out of order. But so this one was a little bit more on the fence for me. But I just, yeah, there's enough drama elsewhere in the series. Perhaps not quite enough in MotoGP at the moment because of the various state of the racing. But I mean, obviously they were happy to see an Italian go back into the lead, weren't they, on an Italian bike? So. I do understand that, but again, I can't help but feel that Dorna are doing their level best to keep this thing going when we should have moved on from it some years ago, to be honest. And I have to say, of the two protagonists in that particular, and I'm not a big Marc Marquez fan. I've said that many, many times. I admire him greatly, but I'm not I don't have a 93 t-shirt when I go to a bike race. Let's put it that way. I mean, obviously I wear my Motorpod t-shirt, but I've never been that big of a Marquez fan. But of the two of them, the person who keeps bringing up the past is not Marc Marquez. And you've got to ask yourself why. Because I think it's old history. And frankly, I'm a bit bored by it now. So it's a shame that Dorna keep trying to stoke the flame.
Yeah, I
I'm
agree.
probably making myself massively unpopular by saying that, but I don't care, really. I'm entitled to my opinion. It's
Is correct.
a dangerous thing to say in 2025, but there we go.
Okay, so that's it. The sprint's over at this point. Nothing else happens. Bezzecchi wins it. Alex is second. Then Digia is on the podium. Then Morbidelli, Acosta, Audiger, Marini, Martin, and Raul Fernandez. That's it. That's
Yeah.
the show. That's where we are. So, job done. After that, we realize now that Bagnaia is completely eliminated from being world champion. It is a two-horse race at this point. It is between Mark and Alex. And Alex being second
Is
did
it
not
though?
score.
I mean, this is such a
Yeah.
redundant argument, isn't it? I mean,
It
I'm
is.
not having a go at you, Jim, but they keep going about the mathematical. It's like,
Yeah.
come on, just look at the bloody numbers.
Yes. Somebody's got a spreadsheet and they want to use it. Damn it. Anyway. But Mark can then clinch at Motegi because Alex, having finished second, meant that he didn't score more than 10 points in the sprint. So Mark has a chance to first match point to win the world championship. at Motegi, as we all said he probably would. Oh, okay. On to Sunday's race. Now, Mark shows up to the grid on the siding lap with a soft rear tire, which everybody starts talking about. Oh my God, Mark's going to be on a soft tire, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, oh, come on, people. He's just going to the grid. He's going to change the gosh darn thing.
It was a lot cloudier and cooler, however, so there was a bit of chatter on the grid about who's going to do what, but this is classic Mark Marquez as well. I don't think it was a, well, it was clearly a bit of a deliberate move on his part to send people potentially in the wrong direction, which I love. I love that.
Those kind of games I loved playing when I was riding, as much as what I love watching it happen here. I mean, it was fun. Like, my big thing was, as a dirt tracker, it would rain. I just have the biggest smile on my face. I would just roll up in the, we're pit lane and everybody's there. And other guys are just like, down. I'm like, smack them on the back. Come on, man, it's raining, dude. Let's go. This is going to be fun. And it just would mess with people. Oh, I loved it. It was fun. I loved it too. I mean, obviously, it was a masterstroke of like make people at least second guess what they're thinking about doing, right? I don't think Mark had ever any intention of going the distance on a soft rear. No way, no how. But anyway, more drama happened on the siding lap as Jorge Martin's bike appeared to have simply stopped or broken in some fashion. Martin could be seen trying to bump start it again as if the bike had just simply quit, as if it ran out of fuel, which more than likely was some form of electronics disaster that happened. They don't know, it is Magneti Marelli on
And
the bike,
let's be honest, Aprilia have a bit of a deserved reputation for bikes starting to not behave themselves as the season gets towards its latter stages.
very true, very true. So everybody kind of settles out on the grid. Mark does go to a medium rear to be medium, like everybody else that was there. Bez gets off to the whole shot, followed by Mark, followed by Alex, followed by Quartararo, Digi, and Morbidelli. Zarco and Mir crashed together at turn four. I never did ever see anything conclusive to decide if it was two individuals crashing or what had happened to that one, Rich.
So I hinted at this earlier on, and again, I've picked up on this through various posts, sort of race reporting and podcasts and stuff. So although Dorna were not being particularly open about it, there were clearly some technical issues across the weekend, and particularly on the Sunday, with regards to replay coverage. Either stuff wasn't getting captured, or there was obviously a glitch going on. So a number of, I mean, we're getting used, although I personally don't like it, so it feels a bit nanny state to me, but we're getting used to seeing such and such as crashed come up as a little kind of thumbnail on the screen, but not seeing the crash until they've decided that, we won't be hurt or upset by seeing the replay. So we're a little bit used to that kind of new normal in the coverage, but they basically didn't show any of these things, and they, for whatever reason, they couldn't, and I don't quite understand technically why that would have been the case. So we didn't really see any of the crashes that happened unless they happened on the feed live, as we were watching it. We didn't see Jorge Martin doing either of his long laps. That was lost. So we were watching what we were watching, and there wasn't really anything else. So yes, big question marks, Jim, about who went down and why, what the circumstances were. But that's just the way it was.
I think there was a statistic that of the whole time Juan Mir has been on a Honda and racing for the factory, he's finished like less than half of the races he started. Crazy.
Yeah, because he didn't even start the sprint because he crashed in qualifying, if you remember, on Saturday morning and hurt his neck. So he didn't take part in the sprint, but he did start the Sunday race, didn't he?
Yep. He did start Sunday race. I mean, he wanted to try to get data and progress with the bike and all that good stuff. Either way, Rins and Augusto Fernandez had jump starts, so they would get double long laps, of which we never saw those two guys going through them either.
Didn't see the
So
jump starts either.
didn't see the jump starts either. So it's like, okay, well, I'll take your word for it. Aguirre crashed. Acosta got by Morbidelli on an aggressive move. He was fifth at that point. And then Acosta got by Quartararo, so he got to fourth. And then Acosta's KTM then failed him as the chain self-destructed and flung itself to the moon. There is a great picture. I think Simon Patterson has it on his Instagram or Threads feed. Go check it out. It's a picture by a photographer. It has the chain coming off of the bike. And going into orbit as it has been launched out of there. Apparently, there's a rash of bad chains or something at KTM.
Well,
Who knows?
I've taken particular notice of this, and this was specific to KTM. And of course, a lot of people sort of saying, oh, are they kind of running chains multiple races and they're wearing them out because they haven't got the money, blah, blah, blah. No, it's nothing to do with that. So it's something specific to the way the KTMs, because obviously this happened to Binder as well. And I think it might have happened to one of the Tech 3 bikes as well over the course of the weekend. Something specific to the way that they were running the setup with the chain, a combination of the chain, the ride height device, and the severity of the curbs on certain corners at Misano. Just putting so much load through that, they were just breaking the chains, whereas other people weren't. And somebody had spotted that. I think they said it was Yamaha are running quite a tight chain guard now, or some mechanism to try and control the travel on the chain a little bit. Because again, with these ride height devices, if you've pointed out numerous times, Jim, they're so severe in the way that they engage and disengage. You know, it's adding another complication mechanically to some of these other components, which, because how often do you see chains coming off or breaking on racing motorcycles? I mean, it's pretty rare, isn't it?
It's extremely rare in the 500s, 990s. There might have been one. I mean, you might have seen one. I mean, one in the entirety of the whole 990 era.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just super odd, but for them to do it there. But I get it. I mean, if you're running the chain, you got the ride height, you got to have that. You've got this, as the chain's got a torque, it's trying to go up. As you try to drop the bike down, now the pivot changes. Now you get this, you get a whip effect. I got my hands pointed up like in a triangle, and it's going to snap it down. That snap force down is going to be huge.
Yeah.
And apparently maybe that's KTM's now being so super aggressive, because if you're wanting to run an aggressive angle on the swing arm to help you when it flattens out, because that's your pivot point, and that's a weight transfer idea to get traction or something to help them, etc. I could see where there you could easily start destroying chains without too much problem.
And the comparison that, again, somebody else mentioned, which makes a lot of sense, where you see bikes, you know, more often throwing a chain, is somewhere like the Isle of Man TT,
Sure.
where bikes are jumping, they're putting the chain through travel that is not normal. And with ride height devices and severe curbs, and a setup that's maybe just a wee bit off, that I think is why KTM in particular were having some difficulties. So I don't think it's a budget related thing, because immediately people were kind of jumping onto the social media platforms surmising that that was the issue, and I'm certain that's not the case. But yeah, Pedro doing rude gestures at his bike was rather entertaining,
Yes.
I thought, rather reminiscent of John Hopkins doing precisely the same thing to his Suzuki at Assen in I was there I was literally sat on the other side of the track,
Oh, cool.
and I think that was It was the last year that Aston had the long track before they
Neutered
butchered it into what it
it.
is today. Still a great track, but 2005, maybe 2006, perhaps. I can't quite remember. It was a long time ago. But yeah, I remember, yeah, John giving his Suzuki the double bird as it expired on him right in front of me. It was very entertaining.
Yeah. Then we got a replay of Bez losing the little front aero device that sort of hangs off of the cover of the front brakes,
Oh, yeah.
and then kind of, I guess, cleans the air up around the wheel and the spoke there. One of them broke off. I'm like, well, great replay. Where's all the other cool replays, as you have mentioned? Again, that's why I sort of left that for here, and put it in here, because that. Then Pecco was down mid corner with the front washing out in turn 14, and you could see the disgust on that man's face through the helmet, through the dark visor, that like this, I can't. There was a realization, much like Marc Marquez had with Honda, that I can't do this anymore, is kind of where Pecco is. He's not there, but he's really close. Like, he stood behind the tire wall for quite some time, sort of gazing onto the racetrack, trying to figure out what he was going to do, sort of like Mark did at Sachsenring with the Honda.
Yeah.
It was really eerily similar to each other in my mind.
It's almost like the Ducati's gone back to the understeering monster that it was before Dovi turned up there. And Pecco can't get the thing to stop the way he wants. Now, whether that's because Mark is so good with the front end of a bike, which obviously he is, or is he just taking the bike to the next level and nobody else can keep up and they're having to override it and make mistakes in the effort?
I'm going to go to something that was posted by the TNT group by Neil Hodgson early in the year, was how much Mark uses the rear brake to set the motorcycle going into the corner.
Yeah, he kept mentioning it this weekend, actually, on the TNT coverage. Now you say that,
Yeah.
yeah.
I think that Mark rides that bike in a way that is demanded of it by using the rear to have the grip of the Michelin, because we know the rear grip is amazing. And uses that to set the bike and gets it down to a point where he then can pivot it with the throttle. He kind of uses the back to maybe pin the front to change the weight transfer between the two.
So he's kind of unloading the front a bit, so taking less pressure off the
Maybe.
front. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's something there. I think that's where it is mostly, to be honest. But who knows?
Yeah, interesting. Can I just say something, Jim?
Yo, go
Something
ahead. Yes.
interesting in World Superbike that's been very noticeable this year, kind of on the same way, and that is that Bautista, who's really struggled with the bike, partly because of the ballast that was put on, but that's kind of just accentuated a problem that was already there, I think. And so he rides the bike, it's really high at the back, whereas Bulliger has the bike like several centimeters lower setting on the rear, clearly to get more weight on the rear tire and less on the front. It's just an interesting parallel. I mean, it might be completely unrelated, but and there's been this trend in on the Ducatis in World Superbikes to sort of put more onto the rear end, and it kind of feels a bit, as you say, that that's what Mark is doing through the rear brake to take a bit of pressure off the front. Whereas Pecco is famously a front ender and now seems to just not be able to slow the bike down, and the thing just oversteers wide, as he did on Sunday when he went down, because he was quite wide at that point, got out onto the dirty part of the track, and down he went.
Yep, very possible. Back to the racing action here. Bez screws up on lap 12. Mark gets by going into 8. Bastianini was then down at 14, we heard. And at that point, basically, the race is pretty much done at this point.
Yeah.
There's a bit of concern as Mark gets a track limits warning. And there's also the fact that towards the end, Bez actually starts to take the gap that was about 0.6 of a second. He cuts it to about 0.3, but the very next lap, Mark is doing the fastest lap of the race. This is never in question whatsoever at all. Some people will say Bez kept it interesting. I'm going to tell you, no, it wasn't for all that. And the race finishes as Mark winning, Bez is second. He did his Bez. And then Alex is third on the podium. Then it's Frankie in fourth. Digia is fifth. Audiger comes to sixth. Marini's got a seventh. That's 2 sevenths on the weekends for Marini. The Honda looking really decent, at least in his hands right now. Then Quartararo eighth. Oliveira ninth, which was a pretty good ride for Oliveira, given all things considered. He really hasn't been anywhere near the front and happened to be this time. And it wasn't really, I guess there was some attrition to it, but he's in a top 10. Then Binder. Raul Fernandez, Jack Miller, Jorge Martin, Augusto Fernandez gets a point, or 2 points, sorry, on the V4 Yamaha. Then Somcat Chantra and Zarco was classified as 16th. That's the, now we got the championship standings. Mark is on a 512. His brother's on 330. That's 182 points difference. I think he can, Mark cannot win the championship in the sprint race. In Motegi, Mark has to win, I think, the sprint, and then he can be win, and Mark Alex can be second, and he would still be champion, I believe. Otherwise, there's a million permutations if Alex isn't second, but it's a foregone conclusion, I think.
He just has to outscore Alex by like a single digit of figures. I can't remember if it's like 5 points or 3 points or something across the weekend.
Is it eight, maybe?
It's a tiny number, really, in
It's a
the
tiny
overall
number,
scheme of
yeah.
things. So I mean, it's not a question of if it's going to happen. It's just a question of when it's going to happen.
Yep. And really, Bezzecchi with a couple of good runs has vaulted himself to fourth over Acosta. Morbidelli is, sixth. Can anybody catch Ben Yahya? I mean, Bezzecchi has a great possibility. He is only 8 points behind
I think
Ben
Bez will
Yahya.
overtake him.
I
I really
fully agree
do.
with you, Rich.
Provided Aprilia don't have their annual breakdown of operations in the flyaways, because that has been a problem. But they really, having had that problem in recent seasons, they really shouldn't have it this time around. But Bez is, yeah, he's starting to look like the real deal, isn't he? Now.
He really is. I mean, I voted for Bez for rider of the race.
Oh, I
Yet
totally agree. Totally agree.
the fans voted for Mark. That's fine. We're allowed to do fans are allowed to do whatever they want. But I thought Bez just all weekend was just I don't want to say superb, but on top of his game, or it's really shown that he can lead the team.
My overarching feeling about Bez this weekend is that, and particularly in qualifying through Curvone, I didn't mention it when you were talking about qualifying, but the bike was like really, really twitchy. And you know, they're going through there at what, 160, 170 miles an hour? Probably a bit more.
They're a tick under 300 Ks,
Okay.
which would be 180, maybe old money. Let me look real quick.
Put it this way. If you've got a bike that's moving around quite violently underneath you at those sorts of speeds, you need to be fully committed to keep on doing it. And the bike, it's pretty clear that they've, and we said again, we touched on this last time out, the Aprilia has fundamentally changed this year. It's not as great at the places where it used to be great, but it's generally better everywhere. They've had one rider who's been injured most of the year, and a stand-in kind of in Salvadori, who's, you know, with the greatest respect to the guy, is not a kind of front-running MotoGP rider. He's a brilliant test rider, and he's a solid reserve, but he's not Jorge Martin. And Bez, who I keep having to remind myself, this is his first season on the bike, and he had a pretty tough few rounds as he kind of got used or semi-used to the Aprilia, and he's now really starting to understand the bike, and it still looks pretty uncomfortable to ride at certain tracks, as I say, through Cavonia in particular, and particularly in qualifying. The thing was moving around in a way that I thought looked a bit dangerous, quite frankly, and I was worried he was going to kind of fall off at a high speed. But he's got full commitment. There's absolutely no question about his commitment to do the best he possibly can, and tallying on an Italian bike in Italy. Yeah, for me, rider of the weekend by a mile. Because that's not to take anything away from Marc Marquez, but he did crash out of the lead in the sprint. He didn't qualify as well as he would normally do. He was fourth. And okay, he won the main race, but you know, he's been winning most of them, hasn't he? So, whereas I think Bez is just outperforming the bike a bit at the moment. And it's a shame that Jorge Martin's been as injured as he has this year. And you know, obviously he had a problem with the bike on the warm-up lap in the main race. And so, where did he finish? 11th or 12th, was it? Jorge Martin with two double long lap penalties. It must be,
13th.
or a double long lap penalty. So that was a pretty good ride. And, you know, he's clearly getting better. And if he can stop falling off and hurting himself, you know, he'll be a contender next year, probably. So, yeah, MotoGP, although the 1000cc with all this horrible aero and ride heights and bloody, bloody, blah, has become a bit of a sort of a bore fest at times. I think next year could be quite an interesting championship if Aprilia keep on this trajectory. KTM are improving. There's one or two Ducatis that are doing okay. One of them, obviously, is doing really, really, really well. I think next year could be quite good, Jim. Best season ever, as Martin used to say.
Yeah, I don't think next year is going to be dull. Part of it might be because Ducati is suffering Marc Marquez syndrome because he just can simply do whatever he wants with the bike. That's why we watch, right?
I mean, unfortunately, the biggest intrigue next year is going to be, does Mark carry on after 26?
Oh yeah. Oh
I'm
yeah.
not convinced, but
I think he does. And because it would add to Marc's goatness. So Marc would have won on thousands, right? He would have won on a Honda, on a Ducati, then he could win on an 850, and I think he wants to do that. And I think he wants to put a couple of championships between him and Rossi, so that because honestly, the people who are the Rossi fans will say Rossi's the GOAT because Rossi has one more world championship than Mark does. And Mark, if Mark ties it, right, and everybody's gonna be like, well, it's equal, but Rossi's still better, blah 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 blah. If Mark wins the title again in 26, he'll have one more title than Rossi. And people are going, eh, it's one title. I think he wants to put it on a pedestal so far removed that there's no way that anybody could possibly look at him and go, well, Rossi was better than you. You know what I mean? I
No,
think
I
he's
do.
driven. I think he is driven to that point that he wants to do that.
So, Here we go then, Jim. If Honda continue to improve in the way that they are, do you think he will go back there to finish off his career?
Oh gosh.
Dramatic pause.
Yeah, sorry. I've not contemplated this at all ever, because I never thought, even though the door was open, I don't think he'd go back.
I still think his heart is at Honda, to be
I believe
honest.
that, right? I believe that's true.
And an improving HRC. Now, obviously, there's the complication of the 2027 reset. And do Honda come out with a RCV 211V? Or do they come out with that? What was it? The RCV 212? Was it the 800? Whatever they called it. It could go either way, couldn't it? We just don't know. I mean, if Mark does decide to soldier on, and Honda look like they've reclaimed their position, I could see that happening, which then begs the question. If Bagnaia's out and Marquez leaves, who would be on a Ducati in sort of 27, 28? This is wild speculation, but we enjoy this.
Yeah. I don't think Mark leaves Ducati until after the 27th season. If he leaves, it will be after that. And then if he does go, it's going to be because the Honda was really close to them, or the Honda almost beat them or did beat them in 26. And he's going to go there and just have that. If he goes back at that point, it would be a 1 year deal. He'd probably win a championship for Honda and close the chapter and say, I'm done. This is it. I won one more for the people that I cared about the most, or who supported me the best, or however you want to say it, or whatever. And then he, basically walks off into the twilight, and you're never going to see Mark Marquez again.
Yeah, because for me, the psychology is always an interesting aspect to some of this stuff. I mean, Mark got to the stage with Honda where he had to leave because he wants to beat Rossi's record. I mean, there's clearly, although he doesn't carp on about it in the press like the other one does, he wants that record. And like you say, he probably wants to put it fairly way out of reach for anybody else. For me, the Ducati thing has always felt like a move of convenience to help him achieve that aim. And I sort of see his heart taking him back to HRC at some point if he wants to bookmark his career. I really can see that happening.
So he has a guaranteed ride with Ducati in 26, correct?
Yeah.
I think it would be very interesting to see what happens in 26. If in 26 he doesn't have a world title, another world title on a Ducati, he may jump ship to try to get another one to put it on the shelf above Rossi. And then again, he may say, I don't see anything that Honda's got. The rules, better the devil you know than the devil you don't. And stay there. Although all the ride height devices and everything are all gone.
Yeah,
They're all
it's a
banned.
massive change, 27, isn't it?
Huge
It's
change.
colossal in so many different ways. Mark Marquez is very clearly making the difference on the Ducati. And okay, Alex Marquez is very strongly in second place, but put Alex Marquez on a 25 bike next year, he might suddenly have a Bagnaia kind of problem. And the rest of the teams are really closing in fast now with the possible exception of Yamaha, but they're clearly making great efforts. Honda are getting better, KTM are getting better. Aprilia is arguably maybe not quite at the Marquez Ducati level, but it ain't far off. So next year's going to be tight, I think.
The Aprilia, I think, is the best bike on the grid right now.
Arguably,
There's a strong argument to be
there is a
made
very
that
strong
the
argument.
Aprilia is the best bike on the grid at this moment.
Yeah. And the only thing that's making Ducati as good as it is Marc Marquez.
And the 24s that are between him and Bezzecchi in qualifying. I mean, kind of, to some
Yeah,
extent, right?
but that's really only been Alex Marquez with any regularity. I mean, Didier and Morbidelli pop up from time to time. Who else is on it? I mean, Aldegar is a rookie, so you can't really kind of factor him in quite to the same extent. And that's it, isn't it? I mean, yeah, the sort of the Ducati and Marder that we were talking about a couple of seasons ago, which was a thing, has kind of sunk out in the deep water at the minute, as far as I can tell. And that is unlikely to get better for them next year. And there is this kind of overarching doubt about whether or not Marquez is going to damage them in the longer term through his sheer brilliance, which is a weird thing, but Honda can tell you all about it.
There, somebody's gonna write a book about it.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Anyway, yeah, no interesting thoughts.
Yep. All right. Well, I think that's everything, Rich, don't you? I think we're all good there.
I do.
All right. With all of that said, folks, since you have a weekend off, please ride safe.
Yeah, enjoy it, everybody, and rest in peace, Charlie.